You've tuned in to the PDU Podcast, a production of EMS Radio. The PDU Podcast brings together industry experts and seasoned professionals to discuss topics in the assessment and management of the pediatric patient in the out-of-hospital environment. You can interact with us at pd-u.com, on Twitter at PDU, email us at podcast@pd-u.com, or call us at 716-245-5336. Welcome to the PDU Podcast, your only pre-hospital podcast focused on the pediatric patient. My name is Kyle David Bates, and we are back after a little bit of a hiatus after all the holidays. Hopefully, your holidays were good. Hopefully, they were productive. Hopefully, you are having a new year. And to start off our new year, we are coming to you with a very exciting topic, something that, well, whenever we talk kids, always makes people a little nervous as it is, but when we bringing the topic of children with special health care needs, it sets it off a little bit more. And that's what we're here to talk about today. So I want to introduce my panel today. It's a small panel, but that's good because it's a topic that we really want to stay focused on. And joining me today is Dr. Patricia Cantwell. How are you today, Dr. Cantwell?
I'm doing great, Kyle.
Thank you for joining us tonight. How was your holidays and New Year?
Absolutely fabulous.
Well, it's great. I'm so glad to have you. Now, can you just remind our listeners where you're from and what you do?
I am the Division Chief of Pediatric Critical Care Medicine at the Holtz Children's Hospital with Jackson Memorial Hospital in Miami, Florida. And I'm also a medical director for Tilly Kids, which is a hospice initiative for Heartland Hospice.
Oh, wow. That's quite a role that you've undertaken in there.
I think the transition to palliative care and hospice medicine has kind of been a segue from critical care medicine when we've recognized that a lot of the technology and support that we have in the ICU setting sometimes allows us to do things that perhaps we need to give a lot of serious thought to do about whether it indeed is the right thing for the child.
Absolutely. And in our last podcast, folks, if you didn't catch it, please go back into A Death of a Child, our three-part series. We got into those topics and addressed them quite in depth. So thank you so much, Dr. Cantwell, for joining us today.
A pleasure.
And, of course, on the other side of the mic is Dr. Lou Romig. Dr. Lou, how are you?
Good evening. I'm wonderful. How are you?
I am doing fantastic. How are your holidays and New Year?
Uneventful, which sometimes is the best thing to ask for.
Absolutely. So thank you for joining us tonight. We're going to hop right into this. Like I said, we're going to talk about children with special health care needs and really kind of focusing on airway management and tracheostomies. And we're starting to see with hospitals, we're starting to see with technology, more and more insurances, we're seeing more and more children being sent home with their technology, almost high-tech kids, if you would. And it wasn't too long ago that I received a call for a child having a seizure. Now, seizure with a fever, fever with a seizure, we're not sure. We talked about that in one of our earlier podcasts. But I arrive on scene, and here's a two-year-old child who is in an active seizure. And she's actually in status epilepticus at this point in time. She has a trach. She's being ventilated by the home healthcare nurse. And we're starting to wonder what is going on. Well, luckily, she had a trach because, as we know with seizures, one of the problems that we have is providing ventilations. And she was refractory to any of the medications we have. Matter of fact, it took the children's hospital over an hour to bring the seizure under control with all the medications that they had. But luckily, we had an airway because of the trach. Now, we're starting to see more and more kids with trachs on that, and it brings about a whole bunch of different complications because we have to understand that when we have the trach, we are now bypassing the upper airway. So let's start right there in terms of bypassing that airway. What kind of problems? What's the big issue with bypassing our upper airway?
Well, you know, the biggest problem with bypassing the upper airway is that it's not the usual flow of things. So particularly when it comes to kids, if you're dealing with a situation that is showing you abnormal anatomy or abnormal physiology using a change in anatomy, it tends to throw people for a loop. What you have to realize is that, yes, the upper airway is still there. In some cases, it may be obstructed. It's still there, so it is still potentially useful. But now you have this new access to the airway, and you can either view that as a blessing or a curse. If you don't know what to do with it, you can look at it as a curse. If you know the advantages of having that available to you, boy, that sure can be a blessing.
So I guess we should really start out is, what is a trach? And when do patients receive trachs?
A trach basically is an artificial airway. A hole is created that joins the outer portion of the anterior neck to the trachea itself. It's called a stoma. So there is a canal now that connects the outside of the neck to the trachea. So therefore, air can go directly in through that hole into the main stem, into the main trachea, and then enter the lungs that way. Now, just because air is going in that hole now doesn't mean that air is not also going in and out through the regular part of the airway. Some children have trachs because they have upper airway anatomy that makes it difficult to get air in and out of the upper airway. For example, some children may have a syndrome called Pierre-Robin syndrome, where there are anatomical deformities at birth that produce upper airway obstruction in a chronic way, and it's very, very difficult to correct that permanently. So if you have a problem with intermittent but relatively frequent chances of having upper airway obstruction due to anatomy, it's always good to have one hole that you can count on relatively well for air to go in and out of that's distal to that obstruction. But important to keep in mind, when you have anybody with a trach, whether it's an adult or a kid, it doesn't mean that that's the only way that they can breathe is through that trach tube. It's the way that you want them to breathe for one of several different kinds of reasons, but it doesn't mean that it's the only way they can breathe. So that upper airway obstruction is one of the reasons. It's probably not the top reason that people get trached. The major reason why kids and adults get trached is because they're not ventilating well, either because of a central nervous system thing that their brain doesn't send the signals to breathe normally, or because there are problems with the muscles, say at the chest wall, that they can't generate enough effort to expand the chest to drag the air in and then to allow the air to push out. So perhaps that child needs a ventilator to be able to provide chronic ventilation. Those are the major reasons. Inability to self-ventilate, either because of a central nervous system thing or muscles that are just too weak. Some patients have problems with chronic aspiration. So in order to prevent that aspiration, then a trach is installed so that, say, with a balloon or a cuff around that trach, the stomach acid can't keep going down into the lungs and causing repeated damage. So those are some of the most common causes of or reasons why a child would need a tracheostomy.
Now, when we talk trachs, and I'll try to put some photographs up on the website, if as long as they have the copyright on it. If not, I'll photograph them because I do have a couple of trachs available to me. You talk about the cuff trachs, but there's also some trachs that have inner cannulas and some that have neither. Who would get what?
Most of the young infants will have trachs that are just plain tubes, much like an endotracheal tube, but truncated, that just is placed without an inner cannula. It has an obturator on the initial placement, which just gives it a little bit more stability to get through the stoma hole on the front of the neck. Children who are older generally have an inner cannula, which is kind of the tube within a tube, and so the outer trach can stay in there for a longer period of time, and in order to make sure that it doesn't clog up with mucus or secretions, the inner cannula is removed and changed, and so the main larger outer portion of the trach doesn't need to be changed quite as often. When children are discharged from the hospital, when they first get the trach from surgery, they have to remain in the hospital for at least a minimum of 7 to 10 days to make sure that the stoma hole, kind of forms a good scar tissue so that when they do go home, it's a fairly simple procedure when the trach comes out to just put another one right back into the hole. They are given usually recommendations to change the trach. Some ENT physicians or ears, nose, and throat physicians will recommend to change the trach every other day, but more commonly, those trachs are changed twice a week. With the inner cannulas, it's changed depending upon how often a patient gets secretions, and oftentimes every week, sometimes every month. But the reason for the very frequent trach changing when children are younger is because if you think about the size of the tube, the diameter of the tube is small. And when that diameter gets mucus or any kind of secretions or just hardened tissue on it, it can very easily obstruct the entry for air getting in and air coming out.
Hey, Patty, can you talk about cuffed trach tubes, both the air cuffs and now the new foam cuffs?
A lot of that, the two different things, the cuff helps to create a seal. It's much like an endotracheal tube at the end. So the foam cups are felt to have a lot of give so that there isn't so much pressure on the tracheal mucosa. The air cuffs do the same type thing. Many times that is dependent upon the child themselves. You'll hear people talking about custom-made trachs specific to the child. Most of the companies can be very specific about making trachs different lengths, fashioning them with what they call a flex tend, which bends not at the part that goes actually into the trachea, but that attaches or that is just left open to air or that attaches to a ventilator just so that it doesn't become easily plugged with any of the soft tissue, the chin or the neck. And the whole character of whatever the cuff is made is the whole purpose of that is to try to avoid getting tracheal necrosis from just pressure, granulation tissue from just sitting inside the windpipe, perhaps being frequently suctioned. And that, just to fit that in, when the suction catheter is passed into a trach, it really shouldn't be put in as far as it can go. Parents are taught to just put the suction catheter in just far enough till it gets to the end of the trach, which is another issue. Many times a trach can get a big plug. If you think about a snorkel piece, it can get obstructed with a very large plug of mucus. And air will go in as you try to bag that child, but the air gets trapped because the mucus will close off and prevent air from exhaling. If you attempt to suction that, the suction catheter often pushes that big blob of mucus aside. And then when you remove the suction catheter, the blob of mucus just moves right back. And that's one of the critical situations where it's very easy to overinflate the lung because as you manually ventilate the child, you'll just keep putting air in. And that situation really mandates a trach change. The other thing with the cuffs, and Lou mentioned this earlier, you need to remember that children will aspirate, whether that it may not be large amounts, but little micro aspiration can actually work their way around the cuff themselves. You don't want the cuff to be so inflated that air is completely entrapped, because if air escapes, that's one of the situations where it actually allows the vocal cords to vibrate so that a child actually can make sounds even while the trach is in place.
So essentially you want to have the cuff just a tiny bit underinflated. And that also prevents having excess pressure on the lining of the trachea.
Correct.
And helps to prevent scarring. Now, if a child has a trach that has a balloon cuff on it, what folks need to know is that there's a little balloon, just like on an endotracheal tube. There's a little balloon, the port that comes out, just like on an endotracheal tube. So if it looks like an endotracheal tube with a cuff on it, that little port there is where you can deflate the cuff if you need to take that trach out. People are concerned, if I take this trach out, am I going to rip through the stoma? Well, just, you know, deflate the cuff if it looks like it's a cuff tube. Now, from what I understand, the ones with the foam, you don't need to worry. You can just go ahead and take those out because that foam is so collapsible that it probably would not cause any damage when you take it out. Is that correct?
That is my experience.
So how much air would you put into it? I mean, are they labeled like an endotracheal tube or?
Well, it depends. You can measure actually a cuff pressure so that you make sure that you haven't overinflated the cuff too much. And that is generally done in the hospital setting. To the best of my knowledge, I just have to confess, I'm not sure whether the respiratory therapists that often will go to the home and check equipment actually do that. They probably can just measure the cuff pressure, and parents are told exactly how much to put in. The majority of the trachs that with the smaller infants are generally not cuffed, or as Lou said, have the gel cuff, or kind of the foam cuff that just forms a seal. And again, when you pull that out, you don't have to really worry about, you know, kind of deflating that. It sort of molds around the trach.
What about sizing of the tracheostomy tubes? How is that determined?
Well, at the time that they're put in, the surgeons, whether it's a pediatric surgeon or an ENT surgeon, can determine from the size of the you know, some of the sizes are a little bit off. I'm hesitating a little bit because it depends upon the brand itself. And it depends upon the actual diameter in millimeters as to which they're putting in. I don't want to just kind of shoot out numbers because a lot of that is dependent upon the particular brand names that you're using. But most of the companies that will advertise their products have charts that go along with that so that you can refer to that. And as the surgeon puts that in, what their goal is to just establish a conduit for air. It's bad to put in a trach that's too small, because the child, if they are dependent upon an outside source for ventilation, or even if that's the only mechanism that they can breathe through, it's just like the teaching with, if you're breathing through a very tiny tube, you're not really going to be able to exhale that much, and it's going to, you know, trap air. On the flip side to that, if the trachea the trach itself is too large, it can cause tracheal necrosis by being sort of shoved into the windpipe and just not allowing for perfusion around the mucosal tissue.
And then as the children grow, they need to upsize the stomas. And they probably do that through a process of dilation. But unlike with adults where, you know, you get one size and probably that's the size you're going to stay, as kids grow, then their trachs are going to have to get bigger in order to be able to, have enough airflow to satisfy their ventilation demands too.
Now, through my experiences in EMS and children and trachs, I find that we're called by one of two types of parents. The parents that they just came home, something's going wrong, and they get scared. So they call for help. Or the other ones are the experienced parents who have been working with their child and they've done everything they can do, and it still hasn't worked. They call for help. I don't know about, you know, in terms of patients coming into the ER, you know, with that, Dr. Lou, but that's what I found in the field. And I think that's something that the providers have to look at. You're going to be coming into a situation that could be very tense, and you're already tense. And what Is there any like words of advice you can kind of give us as we're walking into the scene and we get the parents turning around, the big eyes?
Yeah, there is a pretty good pucker factor there for everybody that's on scene. And maybe the kid is the one with the least amount of pucker factor. I think the thing to remember is that if a child has a trach, as long as that stoma is open, whether it's with the trach itself or with the trach tube out, there is a way for air to get in and out of those lungs, even if the upper airway is completely unobstructed. And that's the minimum of the cases. And in most of the cases, that child, there is a way to get air in and out of the upper airways, even if you have to do it yourself using a back valve mask. So this is actually an advantage because in most kids, you have two ways to get the air in and for the air to be allowed to come out as long as those passages are unobstructed. So you're actually walking into an advantage rather than a disadvantage.
So that stoma is not going to slam shut on me. If I have to pull that trach, it's not going to just close up on me?
As long as it's several weeks old, that stoma should be well enough established that it's not just going to collapse. And that's one of the reasons why, as Patty said, when the kids first get their trachs put in, they need to stay in the hospital for the first week to 2 weeks in order to make sure that stoma tract has become established. So presumably, now, there are some cases in which the trach tube itself is actually stenting the trachea open, okay? So there's a weakness in the trachea that you physically need that rigid tube in there to kind of keep that trachea open. There's a potential problem there because if that rigid tube is no longer there, then that weak spot of the trachea could collapse. But in general, what's weak in, being able to kind of collapse in also you should be able to expand or relieve that obstruction by delivering, positive pressure ventilation with a back valve mask, even without that tube in there. So, and we said this just when we were discussing EMS providers, there are a lot of them that'll walk onto a shooting scene that hasn't been secured yet and be very confident and be comfortable taking care of that kind of situation. Or, firefighters going into really, really dangerous fires where everybody who's smart is running in the other direction. And people who are so brave to be able to do that and confident will run the other way when it comes to, having to take care of a special needs kid, and especially one with a trach problem or potentially a trach problem. And it really is. It's just a matter of, first of all, taking a deep breath yourself, make sure that you're oxygenating and ventilating well, and then sitting down and beginning a systematic approach to your assessment, realizing what the components are of how that child is used to having oxygenation and ventilation, and trying to figure out what components are not working correctly, and then also realizing what your options are if that trach is not working or you can't make that trach work. It's a systematic approach, just like anything else in EMS. If you do things sort of as a routine, then you're not going to miss those little things that can make big differences. And the same thing with a child with a trach, just a matter of being systematic and recognizing where things could potentially be going wrong and what are the consequences if something is going wrong? What are the potential consequences?
Let's give you a scenario here, one that an EMS provider may encounter. So we get a call for a two-year-old with trouble breathing. We arrive on scene, we walk into the house, and we notice that in the living room there is a hospital-style bed there, a small one, and a two-year-old child hooked up to a ventilator with a trach. And the parents are telling me that their child is having a hard time breathing. So where do we start our assessment?
Okay. Where do we always start our assessment? If Dr. Liu is involved, the first thing that you do in your assessment is?
Look at the kid.
Look at the kid. Do your pediatric assessment triangle or whatever you want to call your assessment. Try to figure out, is this child having a good general appearance or a poor general appearance?
Okay, here, I'll give it to you. The child is laying there. Occasional movements, a little listless. Doesn't look at you, doesn't focus. Eyes are deviated up to the right. Breathing, you see some retractions. You hear, of course, the ventilator going. Skin is kind of a palish, dusky color.
Okay. And you ask the caregivers, what's different now about the way this child usually looks? Here's the thing with special needs kids is you have to know what their baseline is. And the best people to tell you about the baseline is the parents and the usual caregivers.
They tell you that their attractions are different. That's unusual for her.
Okay. And how about the level of responsiveness?
She seems a little sleepier than normal.
Okay. So she's got an altered interaction, general appearance, and she's got some increased respiratory distress. Okay. So she's got some increased work of breathing. So this child is in respiratory distress, potential respiratory failure. Okay. So now you've determined that it's probably something respiratory. So now you're going to look at all the components of this child's respiratory function. Now you have a child who has an upper airway, who has lower airways, who has lungs, and now who has a second pair of lungs in the ventilator, sort of, right? And then connecting the ventilator to the child is that tracheostomy and then the various tubing. So somewhere in there is the problem. And there may be one or more problems. Now, one thing that you can generally take for granted is that when you come across a child who is trached and on a ventilator and they seem to be in acute respiratory distress, the first thing to do is to take them off the ventilator and ventilate that child yourself.
Absolutely agree with you on that. And I want to take a pause on that part there and put this over to Dr. Cantwell. Can we talk briefly about ventilators? Because we're seeing more and more of these ventilators at home. And this is, now I want to preface this, and what Dr. Liu is saying is absolutely the way I want everyone to think is, we're not going to sit there and try to troubleshoot this ventilator. But having just a basic understanding of ventilator is, I think, a good thing to do. What are they? How do they function? And what are some of the problems that we may run into with ventilators?
I'm going to be really simple. My mentor years ago told me when I was very frustrated about all of the new equipment that he didn't want to use, said to me, all this machine is something that puts air goes in and air comes out. And they can be very overwhelming to see all of these buttons and knobs on them. But some of the ventilators work with a particular volume that is set to go into a child, while some more work function with a pressure kind of an approach. I absolutely agree with Lou. If I detect a child like you presented, the one other kicker that I would want to know from the family is if the child's baseline is always dusky, just on the outside chance that there might be a congenital cyanotic heart lesion attached to all of the other problems that the child has, which, you know, may be a baseline for the child. And I manually ventilate the patient with an AMBU bag and AMBU bag valve, and not mask, but through the trach. I think that that's important because by the amount of, as you start to just gently bag, you'll get an immediate assessment of if there's increased resistance to getting air in. If there's a lot of increased resistance, that can really be a kicker that there's a huge plug in the trach. And I don't like mnemonics, but I think that the dope mnemonic is an excellent one. When you see a child in distress and there's machinery on and a trach, you need to think about, is the trach displaced, which that can happen. Is it obstructed, which can easily happen from mucus? Is there a pneumothorax, which you can get on your airway breathing assessment, or is it equipment failure? And you don't have to worry about putting the child back on the ventilator. You don't have to change settings. If you just manually ventilate the patient, then you can try to replace them on the ventilator. Oftentimes alarms will go off, and the parents are probably very familiar with the ventilator, but there are some families that just will get panicked and not be able to give you much information. But your own, manual clinical assessment to move air in and out is going to really kind of all you want to do is your bagging is just as you would do with an endotracheal tube is, again, take a deep breath yourself so that you're not rapidly bagging them because of your anxiety, but to just make sure that there's nice, comfortable rise and fall of the chest and then watch for clinical changes as you do that.
And Kyle, just two points I want to make. For ALS providers, a trach tube is nothing more than an ET tube. You manage it very much the same as you do a regular endotracheal tube. It's just going into the trachea further down and bypassing some of the anatomy. That's going to take some of the mystery out of it right there. The other thing to remember is as many times every day as we curse at our computers and our cell phones and our technology, remember that the technology will fail before the child generally will fail. So if there's an acute problem with any child who is technology dependent, the bigger chance is that the problem is with the technology. So go back to the old-fashioned, hands-on, low-tech, high-touch kind of stuff, bagging that child either through the stoma, or if you need to, you know, just cover up the stoma and bag over, you know, generally the conventional way over the face and just go back to the old-fashioned way. Two of those kind of things are going to take the mystery right out of it.
Now, is there ever a time that they will completely seal off the top of the trachea and make a complete surgical occlusion, I guess you'd call it, that trying to bag them wouldn't work?
Not surgical. Now, when they're trying to wean somebody off a trach and teach them how to talk with a trach in, then they'll have different kind of caps on the trach so that, you know, the patient is forced to pull the air in through the upper airways and push it out through the upper airways. But that's something that's very easy to take off it. Otherwise, you know, if you're not able to get air in through that trach, then it's an obstruction of the trach itself.
Okay, so
I might have misunderstood your question because I thought you were asking if, like in the area of the windpipe above the trach stoma,
yes,
was completely occluded, so that
okay.
If the trach came out itself and you put your finger over the stoma and attempted to manually bag valve mask the patient over the oral, you know, the nose and mouth,
that
air just would not go in, and that's rare. It probably could happen from like a lot of granulation tissue that would be an obstruction. But to go back to what Lou said, you have endotracheal tubes and you can take an endotracheal tube and put that tube through the stoma itself.
Yeah, I would think if you had somebody with a really, really caustic ingestion and there was so much scarring of the upper airway that, you know, there's just no way of getting air in. But yeah, otherwise it would be really unusual to have a completely obstructed upper airway.
Because the reason why I bring that up is we actually had a couple kids in one of our, we've got a former hospital here. It's unfortunately, it's where all of our children with special health care needs are now. Parents don't want to take care of them, so they're in this facility. And we actually had two kids that you could not bag valve mask. They did something with the trachea that wouldn't allow us to do that. I guess it was to prevent aspiration or something like that.
You know, that's interesting that you say that. We've had that discussion before, and they did do that. They, there was a child with a high fistula that they just totally surgically closed off the upper airway, and the child, I mean, there was no potential for that child to actually move air above the trach. And that would hopefully be something that you would find out about. And it's also helpful, and I'm sure that this doesn't happen as often as it should, but for medical personnel to try to communicate to, you know, the presumably response teams that will be going to a particular area to just say, you know, give them some medical information about a child with special health care needs that may be in the vicinity is always helpful.
And I'd just like to put in a little push here for the use of something called the emergency information form, which is available on both the American Academy of Pediatrics and the American College of Emergency Physicians websites, as well as available through the federal EMSC program. It's called the EIF emergency information form. And that's a standardized 2-page form in which not just kids with special health care needs, but it's particularly useful for any patient with special health care needs. It's a standardized form where everything can be listed about the patient's medical history, about any particular, you know, history of bad reactions to things, about any particular notes that would assist not only EMS folks, but also emergency department folks in taking care of that child. And there are some EMS systems in which those EIF forms are kept in a kept in a file, or, you know, electronically within the computer system of the EMS system. And then that information is available to the EMS providers and to the hospitals. Otherwise, you know, it's just a matter of handing the form off and saying, okay, here's the information. It's a summary. This is the stuff that you really, really need to know. And so I would really encourage folks to use the emergency information forms. And it would be a great project for an EMS system to identify their special health care needs folks in their areas. And even if it's just a particular station, you know, you're at a station, you have a set territory, find out who those folks are, peds and adults, and take these forms to those households, have them fill them out, show them how to fill them out, and say, listen, whenever you have to call or whenever you have to go to the ER, you know, keep this form up to date, give it to your doc, let them update it, and then make sure that you have it with you at all times that we can really help take care of your loved one.
I'll actually add that form to the show notes. I'll actually download it and put it as a PDF on the pdu.com website.
Absolutely.
For that. All right, so let's go ahead and let's return to our patient. So we disconnect her from the ventilator and we begin to ventilate her. And we notice that there is some increased resistance.
So you're bagging through the stoma. Okay, so if you have an endotracheal tube in and you're bagging and you start encountering increased resistance, what would you do?
Start assessing the tube.
Okay, so same thing as what you would do for an endotracheal tube. You go through your dope mnemonic. Is it displaced? Well, there's not as much of a chance that it's going to be displaced with a trach as you would have with an endotracheal tube.
How do we identify a displaced trach?
All right, well, where could it go? In the soft tissue. So if you have that trach tube that's moved and now it's in the soft tissue next to the trachea and you're putting air in through that tube, where's that air going?
Start to blow up the neck.
Yeah. So you might start feeling hearing subcutaneous emphysema.
Now, Dr. Cantwell, how common is displaced tracheal tubes?
As Lou mentioned, it really isn't that common when they're home. You know, the displacement is that they come out completely, that you see the trach laying on the bed or it's attached to the ventilator tubing. Or what some children do that have special health care needs is to get attention and set their alarms off, they'll remove it themselves and, you know, say, come and pay attention to me. But the soft tissue placement is, you know, sometimes it can get difficult to put the trach back through the stoma if there happens to be a lot of granulation tissue and it may feel like a little bit snug. But again, many times I've had a mother put the trach back in while we were in the emergency department together. I couldn't put it in and I handed it to her and she had the exact right positioning and popped it right back into her child. The soft tissue placements more frequently happen within the first 7 to 10 days after the new trach is placed. And as we talked about before that child leaves the hospital, that trach has been changed. And so that kind of assures the medical team that they're sending a child home who has a stoma that's going to support another tube.
And that development of the false trach is one of those things that people hear about. It's kind of like epiglottitis. They hear about epiglottitis, they get scared about it, but the chances are that you're probably not going to see it except under very limited circumstances.
Now, just real briefly here, we've used this term twice, granulation. Can you explain that real quick, somebody?
Scarring.
Scarring, okay. Well, just want to make sure everyone knows out there.
Yeah, scarring.
Thanks.
Scar tissue.
Yes.
Okay. All right. So we go ahead and...
So it's not displaced.
It's not displaced.
It's not out on the bed. You're not, you know, seeing, feeling any subcutaneous emphysema.
No.
So it's not displaced. So, it's obstruction. What would you do if you thought your endotracheal tube was obstructed?
We would suction it.
Okay. So let's suction it. By the way, the other thing that you would check on an endotracheal tube would be to see if the ET tube was kinked, right?
Oh, absolutely. That's a great point.
trachs are rigid. They don't get kinked off. Now, is there a possibility that it could get maneuvered to the point where the, you know, the holes of the trach, something is up against the side of the trach and it's obstructing some of the airflow? Yeah, possible. But it's not as likely as with something, say, like a NG tube or something like that. So that's an advantage, another advantage over a trach over an endotracheal tube. So we suction.
So Dr. Cantwell, go ahead and let's walk through suctioning a trach. How do we do it? What size? What kind of catheter do we use? Does this have to be a sterile technique? You know, how's this done?
Well, and I'm glad you asked that because as I'm listening to your scenario, seeing the child that's dusky with having some difficulty, I may make a decision to do something that I think would be a little bit faster to alleviate the problem. The parent should have a fresh trach at home, either totally new and in a package, or more commonly sitting waiting to be replaced because it's clean. And if as you're attempting to manually bag and the child looks that badly and there's you feel that there's an obstruction, I would contend that it's probably faster to zip the trach out and put a fresh trach in, and you've immediately corrected the problem. If you've chosen to suction, which, you know, there's, again, it's a clinical assessment. What goes through my mind is how can I rectify this problem as quickly as possible? And, you know, kind of going back to the example that I gave before about the mucus plug on the end of the trach, sometimes I'm not sure that the suctioning immediately corrects the problem. Parents will generally have all of their materials there, and all you have to do is ask for it. Because if you start looking through, you know, your own equipment, you can find suction catheters that can fit through. Again, the size of the catheter depends upon the trach. But when these children are discharged home, orders go out to make sure that there's appropriate size suction catheters for the appropriate size trach, and the parents generally have their suction machine right there. We attempt to do the procedure sterilely. When you open up the suction catheter, you have a gloved hand and you drop the catheter to the what's estimated to be to the end to the tip of the trach, and then suction and be prepared again to give oxygen in between the suctioning of the trach. And it's very frequently if the child has very thick mucus secretions, the parents will have little plastic bullets that have saline solution that can be just dripped into the trach that can loosen up some thick mucus secretions. But, you know, again, the clinical decision making, if the child looks, you know, really badly and you're really meeting an obstruction, it's a pretty quick venture to pull out that trach. And then going back to what Lou had mentioned, very often just alleviating that obstruction to their own breathing, they may have the capacity to breathe. The child's on a ventilator, so perhaps doesn't. But you'll be able to get a fresh airway in with a completely unoccluded area and then, you know, start your general assessment triangle, but yet once again after you've taken care of that.
Now, pulling that trach, Kyle, is a leap of faith.
Okay.
Pulling that trach is a leap of faith because, yes, it's really nice to have that rigid tube in there that gives you direct access to the airway. But people think, if I pull that trach out, I'm going to lose my airway. So here's where folks have to be confident that that rigid tube doesn't have to be in that stoma for the airway to be patent. With the exception of those really, really fresh trachs, when you pull that trach out, air is going to be able to go in and out of that stoma, even without that plastic tube. Okay, so that is a leap of faith. Some folks say, oh my God, the trach is out. It's an emergency. We got to get something back in there. Well, no, sometimes the best thing is to take it out. It's kind of like, as Patty was saying, if you have an endotracheally intubated patient who all of a sudden goes into severe respiratory distress, are you going to, you know, jerk around and play with it and check for kinking and check the cuff and suction and stuff like that? Or do you just have to take a deep breath and pull the tube and go back to basic stuff? Same kind of decision-making process here. except that, again, you know, the trach is sometimes quite a bit easier to rely on, even though that tube isn't in there. I want people to really think about having a tracheostomy, even just that stoma. That's a rescue right there, you know. It's an advantage to have one of those.
So basically, really what we came down to in our scenario here is she's kind of working herself towards respiratory failure. And yeah. Dr. Cantwell, that was basically the decision you're using to say, we're pulling it.
Yes.
She's becoming probably hypercarbic. She's not getting the air out. She's not getting the air in. She's probably hypoxic on top of that, which I think is a key thing also, is is baseline saturations for these kids.
Saturation is not usually the question.
Okay.
Because many of these kids, even when they're on the ventilator, they're on room air.
Right.
Because their lungs are fine. They can perfuse, they can exchange oxygen. The problem is, can they ventilate adequately? Are they able to create enough airflow inwards and outwards to be able to satisfy the needs of oxygenation and ventilation? So oxygenation usually isn't a problem unless it's a kid who has bad lungs. Not bad airways, but bad lungs.
And that's what I was going to ask.
So what you should look for more is if you've got the ability to check end tidal CO2.
Ah, and that's like my next part. But I'm going to ask one question, then I want to lead into the end tidal, is, and I've heard this, and sometimes it makes me cringe, but, well, he's a special needs kid. He's chronically hypoxic. and that's just something that just sends shivers down my spine on that.
Maybe the people who think that are chronically hypoxic.
Well, yeah, some of them are kind of walking around like Smurfs sometimes. but so that's really a fallacy then.
Well, they might be. Some of the children that we send home are kind of home with oxygen saturations that range in the high 80s because that's as good as they're ever going to get, or the low 90s. It may not ding off at 98 to 100%. And these can be children that are on room air, but they just have such severe chronic lung disease that the decision has been made, we're going home and we're going to do the best we can with home health care. I guess if I'm not misunderstanding your question, that could be a normal thing. But I think it is important to just not blow off the fact, well, special needs, chronic lung disease, are not, that's as good as they're ever going to get. You know, it may be true, but it's important to just err on the side of, you know, making sure that you're giving the highest concentration of oxygen available. You know, there are some children with congenital heart disease that could actually make them worse. But again, that's a lot of information gathering, immediately. And it's always best to err on making sure that they're getting highest concentration of oxygen available, 100%. And again, it cannot be emphasized enough. If the only thing that you're measuring is a pulse oximeter, and as you're talking about the end tidals, I don't recall any of the special needs children that I have encountered in the home setting on monitors for that. That can be a problem because people can be lulled into a false sense of security that everything is hunky-dory because the saturations are fine. But when you look at the child, you see the chest moving up and down, but that does not assure you that air is moving in and out unless you use your basic, do your general assessment and really do a good auscultation to make sure that there's good ventilation.
I think that's definitely a great point. And again, my guess would be refer back to the caregivers. They're probably going to know some of this stuff if it's unusual.
They should.
Hopefully. And now, Dr. Liu, you talk about capnography. And I go back to how I opened up the podcast about my 2-year-old in the seizure. We actually put her on the end tidal, the waveform capnography, to see how she was doing. To help us with ventilations and care, mm-hmm. care with her. So, and that's something, a technology we're seeing more and more in that. And now how would that play a role in assessing our child today that we're talking in our case here? How would waveform capnography play a role?
Well, first of all, are you providing positive pressure ventilation?
Yes.
Okay.
It's back to our girl. We pulled her trach. We put a new one in. Mm-hmm. And now we're ventilating her, and we threw on the capnography onto it.
So the capno is going to give you an indication along with your physical exam, auscultation, chest rise. You can even sometimes, you know, feel how much air is moving in and out of the trach itself. All those can combine to give you an idea of how well air is moving in and out, i.e. the ventilation of the patient. Yes, you want to check the oxygenation as well, but there's two parts to breathing, getting the air in and getting the air out. And just the end tidal CO2 is one more data point to building your impression of how well that patient is ventilating.
So I'm going to throw a monkey wrench into our scenario. You have a slurring of the upstroke on the capnogram. You got the shark fin. You're still meeting resistance with the bag valve with a new trach in.
Okay. So then what part of the airway circuit have we not assessed yet or ruled out as being a problem?
We haven't checked on into the lower airway, into the lungs.
Right. So what could be going on down there?
Oh, almost anything. Dr. Cantwell, what kind of things, I'm bouncing this back and forth. What kind of things might we see with kids with trachs and that may end up being lower airway?
As you start to use the AMBU bag to ventilate the patient and you're still meeting with obstruction, you really have to think about the fact that many of the children that are on ventilators probably have some component to chronic lung disease, may have the tendency to have reactive airways or bronchospasm. And so, you know, as the airways narrow with bronchospasm, you need to think about how you can rectify that and again improve your airway resistance. And the fastest way to do that would be with the aerosolization of bronchodilators. Probably the most common one that most of the children are on either on a regular basis or an as-needed basis is albuterol. And that can be just put right into the system as you would just do with an endotracheal tube. Sometimes, you know, depending upon the whole scenario, they can have just some obstruction to flow because they've developed a pneumonia, an infection. Children with trachs are more prone to getting a tracheitis or a bacterial infection or becoming colonized with different bacteria. And occasionally that can cause them to have actual lung infections or pneumonia. And I think those are probably the biggest offenders, and it is important if you are developing or meeting obstruction to think to the dope mnemonic and just think about the fact to auscultate carefully and make sure that you haven't developed a pneumothorax, because in one's vigor to sometimes resuscitate children, you can overventilate them and actually overexpand the lung, which is pretty par for the course when there is air trapping. And if the children have bronchospasm, there's even, since the air can get in, but it gets trapped in the lung, that can be a phenomenon that can very easily happen if there's a component of underlying asthma.
Yeah, one of the most common causes of pneumothorax is positive pressure ventilation. And these kids who are on the ventilators, they're on positive pressure ventilation on a routine basis. And if the patient starts fighting the vent or something goes wrong with the vent and it delivers too much pressure, there's just all kinds of a setup for barotrauma. But it's not at the top of the list. Bronchospasm is at the top of the list. Probably barotrauma second, and then pneumonia and intrapulmonic kind of processes third. And I put them in that order for EMS providers because you can do something about the first two. You can't do anything about the third one.
Now, you mentioned about aerosolizing the albuterol like we do with intracheal tubes. And I have to tell you, in most systems that I've worked in, they don't even have that capability. I think there's been one or two systems that I've worked in that actually had the capability of administering bronchodilators via endotracheal tube on that. Any suggestions of how people can set this up and establish
that? Yeah, if you have a kid with a trach, just go ahead and get a regular trach mask set or a regular aerosol mask set up, and then just put it right up to the stoma. Now, you have to have the right angle so that, you know, you can't lay the things flat, but, you know, sit the kid up on the stretcher, sit the kid up a little bit if you can, and then just, you know, you're just giving kind of like blow-by to the stoma.
But then how would you provide positive pressure ventilation?
Well, you can't do that while you're doing, yeah.
Yeah, they do make setups for that, folks. We've constructed a few of those over the years. It's definitely good to have one or two of those in a bag somewhere, not only for your adult COPDers at arrest, but also for the trach situations. All right.
Hey, Patty, if you have somebody with an intact upper airway and you're bagging through the trach, what if you put an aerosol over the face? Some of it would get dragged down, I would think.
That would probably be reasonable to try. And, you know, as I'm listening to this, you're absolutely right to think about, you know, what do you have and what can work. But sometimes the families may use an MDI component that will fit right into the ventilator circuit.
True.
And can,
yes,
puff right in. So, again, it depends on what equipment they're actually home with. And oftentimes the families will have that all set up in there.
Some of the manual ventilation devices actually have ports on them for that purpose, yeah, as well. All right, so I'm not going to make it that easy, because if you ever rode with me, you would understand that my world is just not that easy. So we go ahead and we assess the lungs. Those lungs sound a little dim, but there's really no wheezing going on, and you're still having that shark fin obstruction. You change the trach, so we have an obstruction somewhere in the airway still.
Well, by the way, is your patient still seizing?
Oh no, that was the one before.
Because if you have a patient who's seizing and they have a rigid chest wall, then that can give you decreased compliance to ventilation as well.
Oh, absolutely. No, this is the seizing one was the one we opened up the case with. This is going back to our girl here, a 2-year-old.
Sorry.
I know I made them both two. It's a mistake. Oh, well. But there's still a little bit of increased resistance in there. The lungs sound dim. No real wheezing on that. Is it possible to develop an obstruction past the trach?
Yeah. Well, let's say that there are other little kids around and they decide that they're going to take a bead and throw it down the kid's trach. Yeah, it's possible. Is it likely? Probably not. Is it possible? Yeah.
Anything is possible with these
Anything
kids.
Anything is possible. But the thing is not, you know, measuring how much air is going in and out. The thing is measuring how what you're doing is affecting the patient's physiology. So even if you're not getting what you think is great air movement by auscultation, check your patient. Is the patient getting better with what you're doing?
Use your eyes.
Use your eyes. Use your ears. Yeah, those are the main ones. yeah, there are certain senses you don't necessarily have to use in that situation. But
taste is never good. Taste is just not the one an EMS would be doing.
Generally not. So reassess your patient. Maybe it's not the best possible, but if it's getting the job done and at least it's better, then you know that you don't have to rush into trying to do anything drastic that might make the situation worse.
So let's go ahead. And we're coming up on to almost an hour here. Let's talk about transport considerations,
mm-hmm,
and the stressors of transport on this child and what we may have to expect with that.
Well, let me just bring out a point that sometimes people don't think about, and this is a stressor on the family and the system. If you are transporting a child with any kind of technological device, in this case, let's say a ventilator, and, you know, the ventilators are getting more and more portable, please bring the ventilator with the child to the hospital, either in your rig or a family member can bring it, because number one, if it was a ventilator problem, it may be something that has to be fixed, you know, before the patient can go home. And possibly that can be fixed while the child is in the hospital. Number two, if that ventilator is functioning and that child is going to be in the emergency department and or the hospital for any prolonged period of time, it sure would be nice for that ventilator to be used for that child rather than that child taking up a hospital's ventilator, which might be needed for another patient. Number three, when eventually that child goes home, if it's a vent-dependent child, if they have their ventilator and they have their usual private transportation, they can probably go home by their usual private transportation. On the other hand, if their vent is not with them, and granted, if they're admitted, somebody can bring it along later, but that child needs some kind of ventilator to go home on. So And the same thing goes for wheelchairs, goes for, you know, various kinds of pumps and things like that. If that equipment is used in that child's daily life, it sure would be nice for it to go along with them so it can continue its role in that child's daily life, because that's a resource that they might have to take away from somebody else, or, you know, they're using up that resource if they're using the hospitals. So please try to remember to bring, and wheelchairs especially, if it's possible, because that's mobility, and mobility is a treasure for these kids who have any kind of mobility problems. So, but, sorry, let's go back to the patient.
But actually, I will bring on one thing on that is safety, is whatever goes in your ambulance needs to be secured and tied down.
Good point.
And that's the key thing. So, like with the wheelchair, odds are family is going to be coming with the van or the car. Help them load it into that for that. So whatever you're bringing along needs to be secured.
But be cognizant about, you know, helping to get that equipment
absolutely
to the hospital.
Absolutely. And that's the key thing. So help them out. And, you know, just think about, you know, these kids are already sick even before you got called. So when we go transport them, we want to just take some, you know, extra considerations on that. Body temperature is one.
Yeah.
Some of these kids can't control their body temperature. So, you know, look and see what the weather is like out, you know, outside, you know, and see how the house is and have a comparable environment.
Especially think about that if for some reason you're calling for air transport.
Oh, yes.
You get these kids under rotor wash. You know, even in comfortable temperatures, you get under that rotor wash and there's a temperature gradient, there's a moisture gradient, it's noise stress, it's all kind of vibration stress when they're in the helicopter.
And even so on the ground units,
yep.
You know, you get the vibration and, you know, you get the guy who's a little bit over anxious with the brake pedal and the accelerator mm-hmm. on that. And it's not the time to be doing that. And, you know, these are sick kids, and they're a little bit sicker today, and we need to be, you know, handle them with gloves and fragile.
And you don't necessarily have to transport them lights and sirens if
Absolutely.
You've got it under control.
Absolutely. You know, matter of fact, you know, numerous studies have shown that lights and sirens saves about 30 seconds.
Right.
And
takes lives.
It does. It takes lives every day. If you go over to our first few moments, if you follow our first few moments Twitter page, pretty much every other day there's a fatal accident involving yeah. an ambulance somewhere on that. So, wow.
So the other thing with transport of these kids, Kyle, is where are you going to take them?
Good
you know,
point.
In this case, the nearest facility may not be the most appropriate facility. If you can get that kid reasonably to a facility, A, that is used to taking care of this kid, and barring that, at least B, has some good pediatric resources and care capabilities, that's the absolute best. One of the best things you can do for these kids is to get them to a place that's comfortable dealing with them. If you're more comfortable dealing with the kid than the facility where you're going, then that patient needs to stay with you for a little while longer until you can get them to a place where they know what they're doing.
Yeah, I gotta tell you, I mean, just the fact of it being a kid, all these facilities have going the pucker factor when you arrive with a kid, let alone a children's yeah. special healthcare needs. On it. Dr.
That's excellent advice. And in terms of leading up to transport, I had a couple of thoughts about a very tragic case of a 2-year-old child who had a plugged endotracheal tube that had a whole constellation of issues and wound up to become very hypoxic and eventually progressed to brain death. But a couple of pointers. A child with a trach in place whose chest wall appears to be moving, you cannot feel secure in putting a non-rebreather mask trach collar on top of the trach and feeling that you're delivering air adequately. The other thing is the families should have the appropriate bag valve device because they're discharged with these things. I recall hearing about a pre-hospital crew that seemed to think that the attachment for the AMBU bag did not fit or accommodate the trach. And I just could not figure out how that happened. I think it was just kind of a misassessment in how to attach the things together. But you have to really be resilient and, you know, figure out a way that you're going to be able to manually ventilate in some fashion. And the families, again, may have the absolute appropriate equipment. And if you don't ask for it, they may forget to volunteer it because they have the suction catheters. Lou mentioned, you know, pick up all of their equipment and secure it and take it. But those things can just be absolutely tragic. The hypercarbia a child can survive with, the hypoxemia may get their already diminished baseline even lower and, you know, either have worse morbidity or mortality.
I think, real quick, we got to talk about bradycardia.
Just really quick. I want to challenge everybody who's listening. Patty's point about just because the chest is moving doesn't mean that they're ventilating. Everybody who's listening to this right now, you can make your chest go in and out without moving any air at all. Do it. And you'll see that that chest can be moving and no air is going in. So it's not just chest wall movement. It's you've got to assess the airflow. Okay, now bradycardia. Sorry.
I just want to close real quickly on, we've been talking about airway and diminishing airway and declining kids. I think we'd be negligent. We can talk bradycardia for a second and airway in kids.
Yep. First drug of choice for bradycardia is
oxygen.
Yes. Thank you.
Good
in
answer.
Kids anyway.
Yes, because that's a bad sign, folks. Bradycardia in kids, not a good sign. It's going to get really ugly really fast if we don't fix that. On that, how long does it take to get bradycardic? What does it take for a kid to get bradycardic with hypoxia?
I don't think that there would be a reasonable number to guess. There's so many factors that would go into it.
Especially talking about healthcare.
And assume it's going to happen very quickly. I do procedural sedation, and one of my cases that went badly very quickly developed laryngospasm, was not able to be adequately bag valve ventilated, and became asystolic and literally within seconds.
Oh.
And was fortunately appropriately resuscitated. And again, as I'm saying this, remember with your positive pressure, the value of positive and expiratory pressure. If you have the capacity to have a PEEP valve attachment, Lou alluded to the collapsible tracheas. Sometimes that can just help you stint an airway open. If a child has tracheomalacia, very soft airway tissue, or bronchomalacia, needing the positive and expiratory pressure of their ventilator, that can be mimicked with the AMBU bag device.
Excellent. A lot of the devices, you can add a PEEP valve to it.
And some patients now are not on what we think of as positive pressure ventilators. They're on home BiPAP or CPAP. So more and more patients are being non-invasively ventilated too. So there's another piece of technology that could go bad.
We'll do a whole other podcast on that. Well,
right.
we've just probably surpassed an hour here once we've done some editing to the show. So Dr. Cantwell, Dr. Romig, I appreciate you so much for spending this evening with us talking about children with special healthcare needs and tracheostomies and the care and assessment of those. So, Dr. Cantwell, is there any closing remarks, some last suggestions, and any little tips that we can do as we close out? And where can people find you if they have a question?
The best way to find me is my office number at the Holtz Children's Hospital is 305-585-6051, or my email. And, you know, trust your instincts. And take a deep breath as you peruse the scene, and do not be frightened by all of the technology, because I think we've emphasized that clinical assessment skills and management is going to serve you well in every resuscitative situation.
Excellent. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
You're very welcome.
Dr. Romig, any last words of wisdom, and where can we find you?
Well, you know, I hope we've demystified trachs and trach management a little bit. You know, it's just another endotracheal airway. ALS providers, it's not that much of a step to, feeling comfortable with an endotracheal tube versus feeling comfortable with a trach tube. And I hope we've shown you that in some ways, it's even better to have a trach tube than an endotracheal tube. And, you know, a trach can be your friend rather than your enemy. And I hope we just took a little bit of the fear and the mystery out of that. You can reach me at my email address. It's Lou Romig, L-O-U-R-O-M-I-G, at bellsouth.net. Or if you feel the need, give me a call at 786-256-1472. And Patty and I are both in Miami, Florida, enjoying the nice warm weather. So you can call us for a weather report, too.
Don't rub it in. We're going to get hit with snow tonight. Or right. They tell us.
Oh, gosh, we might get down into the 60s.
Well, folks, thank you so much for joining us today. My name is Kyle David Bates, the host of the PDU podcast, PEDI-U.com. You can find me on Twitter at ImageMedic. You can also find us on Twitter at PDU, PEDIU. On Twitter, you can friend us. You can check us out on Facebook. There's always conversations going on Facebook, and if you have questions or concerns about anything like that, post a question. You know, some of our pediatric folks and Dr. Lou will hop on and try to reply to that when they can. And you can check us out hopefully bi-monthly now. We're going to try to get this going back going again. We've got the time now. It's opened up a little bit. So, folks, you know, I think Dr. Lou put it perfectly. You have no problem running in to a patient who's been shot. You have no problem running in to a burning building. But when you have that small, drooling kid with a trach, you panic. Don't. Look at the kid. Use your eyes. Go back to what we've taught you. Use your pediatric assessment triangle. Figure out what's going on. When the first thing that you should do, if you have a kid with a respiratory problem with a trach, is and they're on a vent, take them off the vent and start to manually ventilate and go from there. Is this kid respiratory failure? Are they respiratory distress? And that's going to determine what you do. Distress, you may maybe do some suctioning, working with that. Failure, you're going to be pulling out that trach and replacing it. And the key thing, ask the caregivers. Talk to them. They know these children very well. They know what's normal and what's abnormal. So, folks, don't panic on it. We hope to see you at our next gathering here. And thanks. Have a good night and stay safe. I'm gonna hold on to you as long as I can.